Welcome everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I'm GS and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host and Bob, KD2NVB, will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers, as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. We also offer original articles, reviews on many of the topics covered during these technical nets. Publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Club's website, the link can be found on the page of our website in orange colored type, but if you would like a simpler URL to find it, you can just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. We also have an Echo Link node available for use. Just use your Echo Link application and connect it to node KC2RC-R. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month, and all of this information can also be found on our club website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Give us your first name, your call sign, whether you have a question or a comment. It will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Bob, KD2NVB, will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment and recognized offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here on the technical net or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Bob, KD2NVB. Good evening, Bob.
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody out there. This is Bob, KD2NVB, looking forward to a productive and enjoyable net tonight. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good, Bob. I do as well. There were some questions, I think, asked last night on the InfoNet. Hopefully, they have come back tonight, and we can explore some answers with them. Wait, once again, I'm AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net here on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month, starting at 9 p.m. So if you have a question or a comment for the technical net tonight, please feel free, hit that push-to-talk button, give us your first name and your call sign, and whether it's a question or a comment.
Alpha Charlie 2, Zulu Victor, William, I got a little question for you tonight.
Okay, William, you're top on the list for tonight. Let's see if anyone else wants to put their name on the list. So far we have William, AC2ZV. Anyone else? Just hit that push-to-talk button. Okay, well, as always, running a little bit slow at the very beginning. Good to have you, William. What's your question for tonight?
I got a question about VSWR and antenna tuning and stuff like that.
Sure, please. Do what it is.
Question is, you know, how the actual tuner does work. I mean, I understand that there's a transmitter, tuner, and then a transmission line, and then an antenna. And what seems to be happening to me, in my little eye, is that the antenna tuner is kind of pre-distorting the voltage and current relationship, distorting it down the line in a way that when it finally gets to the antenna, it actually straightens out. Is that correct?
It's a little bit more complicated than that. Ultimately, the easiest way to look upon it is that it is an impedance plumbing device for the transmitter itself. In other words, antenna is not going to be at 50 ohms, which is what your transmitter really is designed to put signal out to. Doesn't necessarily mean that the circuitry of your transmitter is at a 50 ohm impedance, that the electrical engineers designed the circuits work the best way for their purposes at 50 ohms. You have to convert whatever ohms your antenna system is supplying the transmitter. If it's mistuned with a 2-to-1 voltage standing wave ratio, that would mean either that the impedance was 100 ohms or 25 ohms, and your transmitter wouldn't really like that. So the antenna tuner is an impedance matching and transforming circuit. It takes that 100 ohms of impedance, shall we say, from your antenna system, converts it to 50 ohms for the sake of the transmitter so that energy isn't reflected and forth into the transmitter it doesn't like, and that it has a good impedance match to be able to put out the transmitted signal. There are repercussions further down the antenna system that help the antenna work, but unfortunately you have to keep in mind that mismatches 50 ohms will still produce reflections on the transmission line, and this is why it tends to be a very good practice to put your antenna tuner impedance matching circuit at the feed point. That will decrease the amount of reflections that cause cables to have insertion losses. Any kind of a transmission line will have some loss depending upon the design of the transmission line and the frequency. If it goes in one direction, it has a certain given decibel loss. If it's mismatched, it will bounce back and forth, and that will introduce even more loss in the transmission line. So that's kind of the shortest, simplest version of what an antenna tuner does, but we can get further into it if you're so inclined.
Well, I've got that much, and I think I'd rather go into further to it. So let's assume for a minute we actually have two power visuar meters, one before the tuner and another one after the tuner, and then there's a piece of coax going to an antenna. If we were to actually see the readings on both of those visuar meters with the tuner tuned properly, I would assume that the visuar meter near the transmitter would actually show closer to 50 ohms. And the one on the other side, I have no idea what it would do, but it might show pretty big VSWR. Is that correct?
It would show you the exact same reading as if the antenna tuner never existed. The only thing that putting an SWR meter between the antenna and the antenna tuner is if you're interested in knowing the unmodified impedance mismatch of the antenna system. So if you turned any dial on your antenna tuner, the standing wave ratio meter between the antenna and antenna tuner would not change. The only thing that changes is the SWR meter between the antenna tuner and the transmitter. Internally, the antenna tuner's SWR meter is wired that way. It's not wired on the other side. It's wired between the antenna tuner and the transmitter.
Okay, so then it stands to reason that the antenna ought to be tuned properly by itself, you know, so that it doesn't actually create a VSWR, so that what we really need is, first of all, to have the antenna tuned properly so that it's going to work on the band of interest, and then the tuner kind of like makes up for any slop. But it seems like if the antenna's not efficient to begin with, it's not going to add anything to it except to not burn out my transmitter when I'm trying to use it, correct?
The problem that ends up on 75 meters with a bunch of guys arguing with each other that antenna tuners are a con, because antenna tuners are very important. And like most things, it's because the answer is somewhere in the middle. It's not just to not burn up your transmitter, it's to allow your transmitter to transmit. Ordinarily, if you had an uncorrected VSWR of, say, 2-to-1 or 3-to-1, in a very primitive transmitter, the reflected power that would get into it would burn out the circuits. You don't want that. and stop you from transmitting at all. Newer generation with safety features would, instead of allow that to happen, they would sense the reflected power. They would drop your transmitter output to a fraction of what you wanted it to be. So you're not really putting out any power. So without an antenna tuner, you would not be able to transmit at all. With an antenna tuner, you were able to transmit. There are additional losses due to the reflections that go back and forth on your transmission line. So in a perfect world, you would be best have a antenna system that doesn't require an antenna tuner. When you introduce that in, you introduce yet another compromise. Also, what's important to consider is the transmission line you're using. In the old days, things were a little bit better in some ways and worse than the others. Open line was the transmission line of choice. World War II allowed the industrial production of coaxial cables, reasonable cost that hams could afford. So although you didn't get the isolation of a coax cable, you got much better loss figures. Though you might have reflections on your open line, the amount of absorption of energy, the multiple reflections, is much lower. This is why a very common design is a non-resonant dipole that's fed through an open line, and then tuned through an antenna tuner. If you tried to do that with a coax cable, losses of matching the non-resonant antennas would be very inefficient.
I can see that. You know, when I did the microwave engineering work, basically we always thought of everything in a different way altogether. We always would talk about return loss. And one of the things we did to protect our transmitters is there was circulator isolators on them. And, you know, if there was actually a short in the waveguide or something like that, it would actually reflect all the power back and it would go into the isolator. And if it was like too much power, it would actually do an arc, and then there was an arc detector that would cut off the transmitter. But most of the time, you could transmit into a pretty bad biswar, and you would still be able to get power through, although you wouldn't get maximum power. And so we were always tuning maximum power by looking for 20 to 30 dBs or in the band of interest. The return loss, it was actually, we called it return loss, but if you have like 6 dB return loss, and that was meaning you're losing, you know, about a dB, and if you had 3 dB return loss, half of your power is coming back in your face, that usually went to the load. That was usually a pretty, you know, a bad joint. Anyway, that said, like it was like a bad joint or something like that. So obviously, we wanted to be in at least be 6 dB to get the station on the air. Then, with everything tuned up, we had to be 20 to 30 dB, depending on the spec of the job.
Okay, but these were microwave frequencies you were operating on, right?
The microwave frequencies. When I'm thinking of, like, you know, 10 meters, just seems like so big. It just seems like if there was a standing wave in there, the nodes would be 10 meters apart. Is that what it is, or would it be 5 meters apart?
The nodes would be 5 meters apart. The full wave would be two nodes. But as I was going to mention, you're dealing with microwaves. It's sort of, like you mentioned, a different world. Isolators in microwave frequencies. I've never seen an isolator designed for HF frequencies. I don't know if they're feasible.
At least no directional couplers are feasible, because that's what the VSWR meters are. And whether or not the VSWR meter sucks all the reflected power into its load, I guess that's a different question. The reflected power's got to go somewhere. It either bounces back and forth or it goes back into the transmitter.
Well, if your transmission line was made out of superconductor, yes, but since none of our transmission lines are made out of superconductor, what you get is an attenuation loss across the transmission line. You know, if you look up the attenuation loss of any kind of coaxial cable, they'll tell you how many decibel power loss over, you know, say 100 feet given frequency. That's for a single trip from your transmitter, your antenna. If it's mismatched and reflected back and forth, well, every trip back and forth is that same attenuation loss. And so it either goes back into the antenna, hopefully, or some of it, unfortunately, because of attenuation loss, is dissipated as heat, as waste heat in your transmission line.
Yeah, but doesn't, like, the transmitter have, like, a better impedance match on its side so it wouldn't necessarily reflect the power back towards the antenna? Or just because of the mismatch of the antenna, nothing is matched and it keeps sinking back and forth?
Yes, the latter. If you have your antenna tuned to a resonant frequency, everything's wonderful. Have a transmitter designed to output to a 50-ohm impedance. It's going into a coaxial cable designed to have a 50-ohm impedance to an antenna at resonance that has approximately a 50-ohm impedance. All is well with the world. When you're not resonant any longer, where you have additional inductive or capacitive reactance, impedance goes up or goes down, and because of the mismatch, it's reflected at the antenna feed point back at its source.
I thought the point of the antenna tuner was actually to make the antenna resonate properly, not necessarily to isolate the transmitter. And so I guess that is maybe a misthinking on my part in terms of what it takes to make the antenna resonate properly.
Yes, like I said, unfortunately, this is a really complicated subject. If that was the case, if truly the theory behind it was that you run the transmitter signal through an antenna tuner and it makes all well with the world, then theoretically I would think that your standing wave ratio meter between the antenna tuner would give you better numbers than they truly do. So, unfortunately, it's not quite as nice and clean and clear, and that's why there's a lot of arguments that go on with what goes on with antenna tuners. In a perfect world, it would be best to have a resonant antenna at all times. There are a lot of cases where, you know, we say that we're forcing it into resonance. Better than nothing. I mean, that's why ultimately a resonant antenna is the antenna that most contest people and really people who take this really seriously strive for. You can tune a doorknob, but I wouldn't want to transmit on a doorknob.
Well, if you're transmitting microwave frequencies, maybe a doorknob would be really good. I understand that's how they actually discovered radio waves in the first place. But let's go back to this. What I think should happen is the antenna needs to be tuned properly. I think that's what the bottom line what you're telling me is all about, right?
In a perfect world, you should have a resonant tuned antenna. The problems are that people want multi-band capability, and some antenna designs don't have the low enough to offer a bandwidth wide enough. 80 meters is the classic case. Most designs for 80-meter antennas, including a center-fed 80-meter dipole, just is going to be resonant at one point perfectly. As you get to either edge, it's going to be worse and worse and worse. And that's where, you know, antenna tuners allow you to get by, even despite that. There are some designs for lower Q antennas for things like 80 meters that make it a little bit easier, but they introduce mechanical problems. Double Zeppelin antennas have a very low Q, a very wide bandwidth. They take a lot of space in a person's antenna farm to accomplish them.
Okay, so this is the bottom line. I got like an E antenna, which is supposed to be multi-band antenna for 10 to 40 meters. And we put it up. It's up on the roof and I have a coax coming down. We put an MFJ antenna analyzer on it. And when I looked at the various bands, there wasn't any spot in the band that come up off the red section of the MFJ meter. And so that means the antenna was basically worse than 1.3 all the way across whatever bands we were looking at, fiddling around, you know, at the time we were doing it. So it seems like me that what needs to happen next is I have to go up there and somehow figure out how to tune this antenna so that it actually will provide the better resonance. Not really sure how that's going to happen, but it seems like you were saying it has to be folded over and taped, but I saw there was one little instruction that said, guess what? You might have to shorten this antenna. So they must have cut it long, and that's why it doesn't work right. But I'm not sure what to do next.
They cut it long because it's easier to shorten it than it is to lengthen it. I've had this conversation with you before. They're kind of designed a little bit large. You have to be accepting that you have to tune it in its location. You can't tune it down on the ground and then bring it up because it's not going to quite work right. So you have it somewhere near its location, I don't know what VNA you're using or antenna analyzer you're using. You said MFJ, but they make loads of them. If you have something more modern, like that does a proper sweep, there will inevitably be a valley. There will be a low point. That low point in your sweep is the present resonant frequency for that element. And based upon where that is and where you would like it to be, then probably we'll have to shorten the length. As you shorten one length, it will have an effect on the other bands. So you might have to shorten the others. When you shorten the others, it will have another effect on the original one. You may have to lengthen it. It's depending upon how much time and how obsessive compulsive you are, it's at least an afternoon's job. You do a lot of sweeps. You decide definitively where you want the most resonant portion of the band to be. If you're not interested at all in CW or FT8 or any of the data modes, then you're primarily interested in an optimized antenna that's resonant across the phone portion of the band. If you're interested in only FT8 or CW, then it's the opposite. If you're interested in everything, then you want it to be resonant in the middle, and you deal with it as best you can. But ultimately, you will have to retune the elements by shortening them experimentally until you get a sweep that you find acceptable.
It's like a really complicated process. I can see why the guy helping me didn't really want to go up and start doing that. That sounds like it takes a lot of communication capability with the spectral network analyzer and people on the roof and stuff like that. I mean, that, I don't know. I didn't know if I signed up for all that when I did this.
AC2GS. Well, I think I discussed it with you. I talked to you about it. It's something that I've been very much involved in. Theoretically, you could do it with either one or two people. You could have a guy in the shack with his VNA sweeping repeatedly, or you could simply take the VNA up on the roof, connect it to a feed line for the fan dipole, and make the adjustments, then hit the go button, take a look to see where the valley of the sweep is, and tweak accordingly. It can be tedious work, but it can be done in an afternoon.
So the actual transmission line shouldn't make any difference, in other words, while you're up on the roof, so you could use the short cable rather than the downlead cable that's already coming back into the shack.
Yes, it might introduce a little bit of weirdness, but not enough to really make or break this.
Okay, well, maybe there was a guy on the 2-meter net said he would help, play around with transmission to come over and work with me on this, because it seems like it's more than I can do by myself. But hey, thanks for all the advice, and I'll check it out and see what my little nano VNA says about it and get back to you another time.
Okay, very good, William. And, you know, if you want to take a screenshot and email it to me, just so I can see what it looks like, that would be fine as well.
Okay, well, I'll see what I can get together. It's hooked up well enough that I can plug the radio in and maybe try to talk to you Sunday morning. But we'll see what happens.
Okay, very good. This Sunday, 10-meter net will be Howard KD2MSU's turn. But I'll listening in the following Sunday.
I think if I can basically see this transmitter work by seeing the power needle on the Visuar meter actually go up, or even the Visuar meter goes, when I press to talk, I should see some indication on this meter that something's happening, right?
I would assume so, as long as nothing triggered your safety circuits and brought your power output down to a minimum.
The situation is that the radio itself has got a tuner in it, and it also has a meter in it. And so I have an external meter, and what I'm hoping is if I have the external meter running to the coax to the new antenna, I'll be able to see how bad the new antenna is really tuned on the frequency we're trying to use. And I should be able to see power and SWR come back on it. So I should get some power, and then the SWR should come back.
Well, keep in mind that assuming you also have that antenna tuner that's separate, you would have to have it in bypass in order to be able to tell what the antenna itself is doing, the meters of your radio. If you don't have the antenna tuner in bypass, you're seeing the partially transformed results of your antenna tuner in action.
The situation is the radio's got an internal antenna tuner and an internal meter, and I've got an external antenna, meter, Visuar meter, that's hooked onto the antenna itself. And so what should happen is I should see some power indication on the external meter. And whatever Visuar indication I get on the external meter will tell me how lousy the antenna is compared to what the antenna tuner meter on the radio actually says.
Okay, yeah, I guess so.
So those are all the assumptions I'm playing with, and I'll keep trying this, and I have a load I can check it into before we get started, and I expect that it's into a dummy load. I should get a relatively favorable representation of power and Visuar, and compare that to what happens when I hook it on the antenna. Got one more question.
Okay, if you hook it up to a dummy load, you should get 50 ohms of impedance. It's non-inductive resistance in the case of the dummy load. So you should get a 1-to-1. You shouldn't get any kind of strange reading. And it should pour the maximum amount of power that your transmitter is capable of pouring into a 50-ohm impedance source, load rather.
So my last question is, is the Visuar meter actually a reflected power meter? Is the Visuar meter somehow actually able tell us, and make this calculation between how much forward power and how much reverse power, and then what is the Visuar between the variation between forward and reverse power?
Okay, basically, you kind of asked the same thing twice. Because if it was just a reflected power device, you couldn't calculate standing wave ratio. You need to know the ratio between the forward power and the reflected power in order to calculate your standing wave ratio. So standing wave ratio meters are reflected, forward and reflected power measuring devices with meter movements that intersect to give you the value of the SWR.
I'm able to adjust the power from like 1 watt to 100 watt, then I should still be able to see the SWR the same way between 1 and 100 watts. The SWR wouldn't change, but the forward power should change. Is that right?
Yes. There might be slight variations going through antenna tuning circuits where power they'll heat up components and drift their settings ever so slightly. But ultimately, for the most part, it should stay reasonably. The ratio will stay the same, whether it's 1 watt or 100 watts. It's just the amount of reflected, it's the percentage of reflected power that determines the SWR.
I think that's really interesting. It doesn't seem to need a power supply except for the LED, so somehow there must be a circuit in there that's powered enough from the transmit energy to provide the SWR reading. That's interesting. I don't know much about the internal guts of these things, but I'm trying to find out more. Maybe we ought to find out if anybody else has any questions, Roy.
Okay, I will do that in a moment. Wattmeters do not have to have power. They can be passive devices. They basically are directional couplers and galvanometers. There are power usages to light up the meter face so you can see it better. There are also circuits that hold to peak output. So that requires some power and some circuitry. The sheer need to assess the amount of watts going forward and reverse can be done without any actual power in the unit. Once again, I am AC2GS. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net here on the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month, starting at 9 p.m. So if there's anyone out there who has any questions or comments tonight, please give me your first name and your call sign.
WB4AIZ. No real questions. I just want to give you a
Okay, very good to hear you, Chuck. I see you on my Echo Link show. Hope you enjoy the show tonight. And, of course, if you ever have any questions or if you have any opinions and comments that you'd like to share.
Yeah, you dropped out a bit. I'm not sure what happened, but you lose some of your comments.
Well, I'm sorry about that. I don't know what to tell you. It could be some packet loss at your end. I'm also connected to Echo Link with another computer, and I'm looking at my level, and it seems to be going good. But, you know, Echo Link and ISPs sometimes don't particularly get along too well. I just said that I'm glad to have you here, and we're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month. And if you ever have any questions or if you'd like to share any opinions or comments on the subjects that we discuss, please feel free.
All righty, thank you. I'm here in near St. Petersburg, Florida. Probably got me on QRZ. I'm in an assisted living facility, and it's not real late at night. It's 9:30. Anyways, this is how I communicate because of no antennas and no power, fancy radios. We got some digital handhelds in storage, but nothing with me right now.
Okay, Chuck. Unfortunately, that's not uncommon. I also play around with hotspots. A lot of people in your situation, it seemed like almost a cliche when I was listening to the American English Talk Group 91, that either their kid or their grandkid brought them over a handy talkie and a hotspot, and got them back on the air that way. Echo Link is very useful. It's what I first used when I was first licensed before any radios. As soon as I got my call sign, I got my access to Echo Link. And not only did I listen in to different repeaters in the country, in Minnesota, there is a couple of HF radios specifically designed to be remote controlled and listened and spoken through. So that was some of my earliest amateur radio opportunities, Echo Link. So I have a warm spot. I maintain Echo Link for this is the Kings County Radio Club. And, I think it's a great technology.
Roger. Got on a net one time. I'm not exactly sure which one, but gentleman, an 8-call, had just moved to Florida, and he really didn't know anybody local area, you know, club-wise. So we gave him a call after the test, and when we were able to do it, go to a local clubs, St. Peter's Amateur Radio Club, here and there in St. Petersburg. I'm not just north of St. Petersburg. And we got to know each other, and he's cool. And, excuse me, my girlfriend is a fan with me for radio voice. And so, anyways, I'm babbling. But, I've been licensed 50 years. He came out of Pennsylvania. So, used to be Pennsylvania's craziest novice. I couldn't use the phonetics for that. Then when I became a technician, I couldn't use it because I was a technician, a novice.
Oh, well, I'm sure you were able to use it for many, many years. Like I said, haven't really been, like I said, I've only actually been in this hobby for about 11, 12 years. Always interested in it when I was younger, but problem, you know, getting up to speed with Morse code, and very difficult to find fellow hams for some strange reason. I think the second ham that I ever met was when I went in to take my VE exam. So those were the third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh hams that I met in life. So I'm sure you got lots of stories. Like I said before, Chuck, you're always welcome here. We have a club info net on Tuesday nights on EchoLink. We have this particular technical net every second and fourth Wednesday at 9 p.m. I also I'm net control operator for another technical net. If you're interested, that one is over at Limark, the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club. Their EchoLink node is W2VL-R. So you're always welcome. Wherever I am, Chuck.
Oh, thank you, sir. You said W2 Delta Lima Char. I'll plug that in and on EchoLink and I'll put it in my list. B4AIZ. Well, I don't want to put it into a red. B4AIZ.
Okay, very good, Chuck. It's Whiskey 2 Victor Lima Ash Mill, and it's every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on the same coast, so it's the same time zone.
You said Victor Lima Dash Romeo?
Whiskey 2 Victor Lima Dash Romeo.
All right, thank you. I'll go put that in now before I have thank you, sir, for everything.
You're welcome, Chuck. Have a good night. 73, be well. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We meet here second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month at 9 p.m., and we go for as long as people want it to go. So if you're out there and you have either a question or a comment, please hit that push-to-talk button. It's your first name and your call sign.
Kilo 2, Juliet, Victor, X-ray, Lloyd.
Hello, Lloyd. Long time no talk. How are you doing there?
Yeah, nice talking to you. Happy secular new year. All's well here. I do have a question. The first question is, do you still have an expert amp? Over.
Sure, Lloyd. Please, ask your question.
Expert 1.5K FA, and I have had the misfortune of having it I've blown out the main FET 3 times now. The first time, I shipped it back to Bob in Texas, and he fixed it under warranty. Didn't have a reason for why it broke. Just fixed it. And then the second time, I'm not sure what happened. Again, I sent it back to Bob, and he said that thought it was the power. And now the third time, sent it to the new guy who's fixing it for Vibroplex, who's assumed the franchise for Expert. And I that, and he seems like a competent technician. He thinks it's drive power that blew it out. And just to give you an update, I'm using an ICOM 7300, an NFET antenna, and the NFET antenna is good from 10 to 80 meters, and I have SWR below 2 to 1 on all bands, pretty much. A little segment of the 80-meter band, the 80-meter side of the 80-meter band is a little high. I would never use the amp on that section. I also followed the procedure of tuning, you know, every in the pattern that they suggest in the manual. So I'm perplexed, and it's a little disappointing. I wonder if I have a lemon. Is it supposed to have all these protection circuits? So I was wondering what your if you've had these problems and what your opinion might be. Over.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear you're having these problems. Thankfully, you know, knock on wood, I haven't had any of those problems. It might just be that you have a lemon. You know, I mean, the beauty of Italian manufactured equipment is it tends to look beautiful, but sometimes you get the idea that the people putting it together had their mind on something else. So, you know, it's a shame that you're having that type of a problem. I know mine squeals like murder if I even try to get it past something like a 1.5 Viswa. So the emergency circuits seem to work reasonably well. Is it possible maybe you're just overdriving it? You're giving it a little bit too much driven power? Because these things, I don't know which version you have, but the American version that has an attenuator built into it to limit it, because the design gain on these things is humongous. But mine has an attenuator, so I don't know if yours has an attenuator. I would assume if it doesn't and you kind of get the drive power a little bit too high, that could be problematic.
I've read the manual carefully, and I've looked up stuff on the internet, and according to the manual, and it's conflicting, they say drive it at 100 watts. I typically try to drive it at 35 watts because that seems a safe range, and I know that... KO8 SCA, he also has a expert. He drives it at like 25 or 35 watts. And I've lowered, you know, the speech compressors are probably out of 4 to 10, out of 10. And my mic gain is maybe, you know, at the middle setting as well. So I feel like I'm not overdriving it. I'm wondering if there's a ground loop. Of course, you know, all the wires behind my radios look like speed dinner. So I'm a little concerned about that. I was thinking of putting in a one-to-one balun between the transceiver and the amp. What do you think about that? Over.
Well, you know, I'm a big believer in RF chokes. Palomar sells those types of very, very high impedance RF chokes, and I've tried all those permutations as well, simply to kind of eliminate any kind of RF in my shack. But they might serve a purpose. Never in my wildest imagination considered driving. I have the 1.5, I have the 1.3, but I think the only major difference is the power module, because at one point they ran out of 1.3 power modules and they just shoved a 1.5 power module into the late versions of that model, and they put out 1.5 kilowatts. So I think the electronics is primarily the same. But no, I don't remember exactly. I've tuned it for each frequency. I've made adjustments of how much drive power I have. I have it wired in with my flex. Is you know, from the band, it sends a signal back to the flex and adjusts the wattage down. But yeah, 25, 28, maybe 30, never 100. But yeah, you know, I don't know what to make of some of their documentation. But you know, if you incessantly have this problem, you know, you might choke it. And also, I would probably crank the power down a little bit. I mean, if you're running maximum at your present situation, how much maximum power output do you read on your meter?
Kilo 2 Juliet Victor, X-ray returning. You know, typically it's within parameters. So on the low setting, it's around 600 watts. On the mid setting, it's about 1,000, and on the high setting, I, you know, talking at the modulation that I'm talking now, can peak over legal limit. Over.
Yeah, I don't know about you. I mine is a little bit lesser. My lower level is at 500 watts peak. Mid, I think, is about 950. I don't remember. And my high is just below 1300. I would type a kind of err on the side of lower drive power to not have it peak anywhere close to a past the maximum, but I'm just a belt and suspenders guy. It might not have anything to do with what's going on with you.
Think about installing a one-to-one balun between the or not in between the transceiver and the radio.
Yeah, I mean, mine is not a one-to-one balun. It's just it's an RF choke. If you go to Palomar, you see that they're really big into common mode choking and all kinds. You know, they sell a lot of them, I guess, and I've seen YouTubes with them. So they're little boxes. I don't know if they're really one-to-one balun or just some other very high impedance common mode type of circuit in the box. But take a look at it.
I will. And what do you think about it? It could be, what if it was a ground loop?
Well, I would think it would be more consistent. It sounds like, even though I realize it's happening to you three times is more than consistent for you, I would assume that if it was a ground loop situation, you'd kind of, it would just be ridiculously common to have it cause this problem. So I would tend to think not. And you mentioned the spaghetti. I think we all do. There's maybe 1% of hams that are obsessive compulsive who have their cables aligned in parallel, look visually stunning. But most of us, if you look behind the pile of equipment, inevitably the wires are going every which way. If you're really industrious and you want to kind of check all it out, but I don't know, it doesn't strike me as a ground loop. Again, under the circumstances that you're describing it.
In fact, that you mentioned that I was watching YouTube videos, and I watched an Ask Dave video, OG, and he went and showed what it looked like behind his shack. Was, of course, a total mess. It was crazy. Now, he uses braided conductors from the ground to the to his bus, ground bus, but the rest of it was, just a ton of wires and turning in all different directions, which you can't help but think is a recipe for a ground loop. It's troubling. And while we're on that subject, I have another question. I guess it's sort of related to this. Why is it that the ground wires have to terminate to a bus bar and then go to the ground lead to however you're going to ground? Why can't you daisy chain them? Why does that make a difference attaching to a bus bar? Over.
You want to have the shortest possible distance to the ground because any signal, say, that's RF-wise is going to introduce impedance and block its free ground path. So you want shortest distances. That's the only real reason for the design of grounds that work that way. It limits the lengths, whereas if you're daisy chaining grounds, you know, there's got to be some piece of equipment that's farther away than anything else. So it's taking a ridiculous journey. By the time its current gets grounded, the impedance along that route is enough to raise the voltage higher than you'd like it to. So that's my understanding of the reasons given.
Do you use a ground bus?
Yes, indeed. I have a copper ground bus right below my windowsill. All my chassis are right in front of the windowsill, in front of the radiator. And I use braided wire to connect all of those internally. And then I have a strap of copper going out my backyard into my cold water pipe system.
Yeah, in my case, I go to a ground rod that I drove myself, so I know that that's good. I just have to, how would you look at overdriving the amp before it gets to the amp, like on a dummy load? What would you put between the transceiver and a dummy load to see that you're overdriving? Or?
Can you rephrase that? Because I'm not quite sure. ultimately, you have to make the judgment based upon the gain of the amplifier. At least that's what I do, because I can't, you know, it's the linear amplifier defines what the maximum gain is. So you look at the power output that putting in, you know, and you know, the best case is you put it to a dummy load. You then put it into either FM or CW, so it has 100% duty cycle, and you tweak the numbers so that the peak power, which is also at that point the average power, is legitimately, you know, below the high end of where you want to go for it. That's sort of what I did for this. I hooked it up to my 6700, and I sat there with the little buttons that you press to program the amount of driving power. It told my Flex to trigger, and I would just crank it down or crank it up depending upon the wattmeter results go into my dummy load.
Manually control the ALC on the Flex radio?
A lot of people have a lot of nasty things to say about ALC. So, like I said, I just kind of conservatively set the drive powers on the linear amplifier that's controlling my Flex 6700, and I haven't had any problems with it.
Are you using ALC? Do you use the ALC connection that the guys in Texas can send you and connect your radio? Is that automatic control?
I mean, he's the guy who made my control cable. I'm not aware that the ALC ever did anything. I don't even know how you could tell if the ALC did anything. The way things is by locking in different gain settings for each band.
Roger that. I'm now getting, you know, the guy's going to ship it out again for the third time, and of course the shipping is profoundly expensive if you endure it, and the amp is significantly more expensive now than what I paid for it, so I insure it for a replacement view, and it's easy, and I got $100 to ship it, and he'll probably charge me $100 to ship it back, and it was that I did that too, by the way, because when they delivered it to him, they dropped it off by his mailbox on the side of the road, and I fortunately put the thing in a plastic bag too. God knows what would have happened to it. So in any case, yeah, I think I'm just going to take it slow and steady. Have you ever put a voltmeter on your ground wires to see if there's any voltage on them? Over?
No, I can't say that I have. Again, you know, probably it would be a good idea, but since I never really had any particular problem, I didn't investigate it. And of course, these things kind of grow over time. Even if I did it at the very beginning when I had the first radio up, I'd have to theoretically do it for the second and the third and the fourth and the fifth and the sixth and the seventh and the eighth. So no, the short version of that is no, I have never kind of checked that there's no floating voltage potential on it.
Yeah, Roger. I think I'm going to try that. You know, I have like a clamp here, and I can put that around the ground wire and see what's going on. That might be interesting.
Yes, Andy.
Hey, Nanette. I was just a little curious about the 1.5K amplifier. I wanted to ask the gentleman a question. Does he remember how he was operating it the first time it failed? What were the symptoms and what was done to repair it the first time?
Respond, Hilo 2 Juliet Victor X-ray. First of all, when the amp works, it works excellently, and band switches very fast, it retunes very fast. In those respects, it's excellent, all automatic. So what happens when it doesn't work, it just stops working. It gives you SWR readings, and it gives you voltage and current readings from your transceiver, but it no longer amplifies. You see no output power, or you see output power, or whatever the radio is, the transceiver's set to. So, and that's it. It doesn't start smoking. There was no alarm. The alarm log on the radio is kind of lame, and doesn't give you any data. It just says, you know, maybe say high SWR, and that's about it. So unfortunately, there's no real data generated by a fault. Over.
Okay. but then the only thing that I left out was the first time you sent it under warranty, what was actually repaired or done before they sent the unit back to you?
So in each case, they replaced the big transistor, the FET, and apparently only has one big transistor. And then they upgrade it to whatever the latest firmware upgrade is. They do that for you as a matter of course. And then they just ship it back, and the FET is apparently can't be replaced. It really needs some high technical skills because it's welded into a sink or soldered into a sink. So apparently it's very tricky. So I haven't bothered with that. Over.
What you're saying is that every time you send it out, the report that you get back, is they replace this output FET with the same model, I guess, the FET device. And it's still exhibiting almost the same system. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's affirmative.
And you're actually on a third time right now. Am I correct? This is going to be the third time you're getting it repaired?
Yeah, affirmative, third time.
Now, I have absolutely no familiarity with this unit. However, I would assume it's microprocessor control, especially with all these safety circuits on and on. And I would have to almost assume that they're not replacing any of these microchips. They're not saying they are, and they're not, and they would tell you. Back in the day when I used to send something in to get repaired, I would actually insist on all components that were replaced to be sent back.
I'm beginning to suspect that it is like a CMOS chip or something like that, and I don't know what they do with those and how they evaluate the programming of that and how deep into the weeds they go in this thing, and it could be there is some kind of fault related to that. I did have one event related to the programming. This might issue, Roy. When I first got it, I tried to upgrade it and went to the website. At the time, you could only go to the website in Italy at SPE's website, and they made a mistake, and they posted firmware for the 1.3 FA expert amplifier, not the 1.5, and I installed that in my amplifier, and the amplifier thought it was a 1.3 at that point, and it wouldn't function properly. And then I wrote them, and they said, "Yeah, sorry. Maybe this is why he fixed it under warranty." They sent me the correct firmware update to bring it back to 1.5K, and then at that point it was upgraded. But I wonder if somehow in that programming process something got altered in some of the protection circuit. Over.
Well, it certainly is possible. I mean, you never know with these updates if all the registers are rewritten or not. So it's not likely, but it's possible.
Affirmative. This is the one problem with solid state technology is it's very hard, if not impossible, to delve into it. And actually see what's wrong or figure out what's wrong. You can't like take it apart like an old Collins radio or a simple tube amplifier. So I think when I get the amp back, I'm just gonna take it really slow and easy and evaluate everything before I start to use it, and also use it primarily on 20 meters where there's no doubt that my NFET is resonant on. Over.
AC2GS. I think that's wise. Again, I would kind of decrease the drive power, you know, so you're not peaking at the maximum and certainly above it. And you know, I mean, ultimately the difference in your reachability with 1460 watts versus 1500 is negligible. So you know, you don't have to. I realize you paid for 1500. You want 1500, but it most likely the components will age a little bit better if they're kind of underused rather than overused.
I agree with you on that for sure. I only use the maximum power breakthrough, a really big pile up on a great DX state, and that's it. And it works. And it works. And I suppose that's what maybe you use it for. But I most of the time just low power. And you know, fortunately, and maybe I'm just going to set it aside for a few years until I really figure this out, or maybe other people on the internet will identify solar problems because the solar flux is high. You almost don't even need amp anymore. Over.
Yeah, that's true. I'm doing 10 meters. I haven't found any real need to go past the 500 watts that the minimum setting gives me. I find 100 watts doesn't quite have as much of the oomph. People can tell the difference. I usually am on with Howard, KD2MSU. He doesn't have an amplifier. He has a lot better elevation. He's up on apartment complex, and he runs 100 watts, and a lot of times they hear me better than him. So it's the 500 watts helps. Probably could down it to 300 watts and still get away. But, you know, I don't crank it up too much these days because I'm not really doing contests. I'm doing rag chews and such. So, you know, if people need 1,300 watts to hear me, chances are I'm not going to be able to hear them very well either.
What, do you hear me?
Yes, I hear you, Andy.
I just wanted to ask the, I don't know his name, but the amplifier, 1.5K, value to me. So when he, after he gets, you know, when it exhibits its problems, when you get the amplifier back, do you put it through its same exact mode and power output, all its settings, and see if it does the same thing? Does it do the same thing right away, or does it take a while before it does the same thing right away, or otherwise?
Hey, that transmission, did you get it, Roy? Can you relay?
Yeah, unfortunately, Andy, you're about 25% noise, unfortunately, because he's farther away from the repeater in Queens than we are. He wanted to know if when you get the amplifier returned to you, if it's operationally in the same shape that when you sent it to them, or it's been modified or changed or settings, or it responds differently.
I guess I'll get on this net, if not in 2 weeks. Month because he's not quite done with it, and by the time he ships it and sets it up again, I'll report what the latest, and he might give me a more detailed report. He's less cranky than Bob was, and I think I might be able to get some technical details out of him. With that, I don't want to hog the net tonight. Thank you. But by the way, give you a signal report on 10 meters while I'm on the net here. I still can't hear 10 meters in the Kingston area now. Either you guys are still strictly ground wave in the metropolitan area, or it's just skipping over me. I occasionally hear other stations calling in and having a conversation with you guys, especially now that 10 meters is open, but I can't hear any of the stations coming out of the sea upstate. And also, I'm on my final transmission here, just to remind anyone else who's listening, has HF capabilities, that we have this Hudson Valley 80-meter net on 3.35, and they meet on Wednesday evenings at 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and it's a good bunch of guys from up and down the Hudson Valley, so anyone has that capability, I recommend it. Anyway, thank you very much, Roy, tonight, and to participate more in the future as I get busier and bigger and then delegate more work out. Thanks very much, and 7-3.
So Roy, if I can have to ask one last question. The first two times he sent it in to get repaired, how long did it take before it exhibited the same exact problem? Right away, or did it take a while?
2 years. Like 2 years, I believe. So, it's strange. Very perplexing, right? It works fine for 2 years, then all of a sudden it doesn't work. It hasn't changed anything. I haven't changed anything in my shack. That's what's going on.
As a final comment, that it keeps getting repaired the same way, and the same thing keeps happening three times. So it's either something in your shack, unique in your shack, is beyond the protection component's ability to function, which would lead me to believe RF is getting into the unit and affecting the microcontroller processes and or whatever it is, the digital circuits that are controlling all the safety circuits, and you have something unique that RF is getting in there, and or it's been damaged and it never gets repaired if it's a microcircuit. So the fact that it worked for 2 years is surprising. It's almost like there's something going on maybe in your shack for the last 2 years and then becomes effective again. So when the right conditions are met, I guess something actually just damages a device or devices in your unit. Okay, very good. S2HOH officer.
AC2GS. Thank you, Andy. Just to get back to you, Lloyd, if you're still listening, there's no way that ground wave propagation is going to reach you upstate. You have to kind of deal through SkyWave, and SkyWave, I don't think, is really going to supply it. We haven't had, even the best of propagation conditions, I haven't had any contact with upstate New York. Just a week or two ago, I had four people almost in a row from Lincoln, Nebraska, of all places. So the skip is rather wide with 10 meters. So that's why you will hear skip from distant places talking to us sometimes, but you're not going to hear our skip because, our RF is way up in the ionosphere when it gets near your location. It hasn't had a chance to bounce down and land on ground for many, many, many miles thereafter.
After that, that's what I suspect. So I'm totally being skipped over. It's surprising that someone doesn't, with people's wires, that they don't, if someone's transmitting on a horizontal wire on 10 meters near net, that I don't get an NVIS signal.
I think you're still a little too far away for NVIS. That's the problem. You're not far enough away for SkyWave. You're not close enough for NVIS.
Roger that. Roger that. Well, anyway, I won't hold it. So I'll say 7-3, and good talk to you again. Hope to make the next meeting and be in touch on this net in a few weeks to tell you about what happened when I got the amp back.
Okay, very good, Lloyd. Always a pleasure, 73. Talk to you down the line. Again, I'm AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We meet here on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month, starting at 9 o'clock and going for as long as anyone has any questions. So if anyone has any further questions, we're still open for business. If not, we'll go to the TechNet puzzle. First, let's see if anyone out there has any questions or comments to make. Hit that push to talk. Give me your first name and your call sign.
Hey Roy, this is KG2VEA.
Hello, Maxim. How are you this fine evening?
I'm doing well. Enjoying the conversation. Always learning. There's a lot of things that other folks can do that I can't do where I am due to space and antenna restrictions. So it's always interesting to see what people are doing. I kind of want to talk to you a little bit about WiresX and get kind of a high-level understanding of how we use it from a club perspective, but I think that might be a longer conversation I might want to reserve for 2 weeks from now and go to the puzzler. What do you think?
Well, if you want to, we can do it now, but, it is 10:22. I'm sure some people are kind of looking forward to their bedtime. We could discuss WiresX for at least an hour. There's a lot to cover. I don't know how deep you want to dive into that hole.
Got it. Longer than 5 minutes. Let's go to the puzzle. Let's do that. I can bring it up in 2 weeks.
Okay, very good. Our puzzler doesn't have any illustrations, thankfully, so I can read it out loud. It's relatively simple if you know the subject. The question is, in which type of semiconductor does the capacitance vary with charging voltage? You have four choices to select one for the best answer. Choice A is Zener. It's a Zener diode. Choice B is FET, field effect transistor. Choice C is germanium, and choice D is varactor. So would anyone like to hazard a guess on tonight's puzzler?
82NVP, can you repeat the question? Unfortunately, I can't find the page also. Maybe I don't have it up yet for 2023. Anyway, can we just repeat the question for now?
Sure. The question is, in which type of semiconductor does the capacitance vary with changing voltage?
I'll pass it along because I just don't know. Maybe I knew this when just before I took the exam. Back to net.
Anyone else out there want to hazard a guess? We don't take points off for the wrong answer.
KG2VEA, how about, was it FET?
Okay. B is FET. FET is a field effect transistor. Field effect transistors were kind of the second class of transistors that were designed, bipolar transistors that we all know and love, the NPN and the PNP. Bipolars were current-controlled transistors. They turn things on and off and amplify signals. Field effects transistors do the same, but they're voltage-related as opposed to current-related devices. So they operate somewhat similarly to old-time vacuum tubes, which were also voltage-related control and amplifying circuits. They do not change their capacitance with varying voltage. Any more guesses? No one wants to hazard a guess. You now have three choices. You have a Zener diode, germanium, and a varactor.
All right, I'll go with A now.
Okay, a Zener diode is specially designed to have specific breakdown voltage. So it's very useful in things like circuits, safety circuits, where the voltage potential goes too high, and so it shorts itself out. It's also very good in power supplies as a cheap voltage regulation circuit, but also does not change its capacitance with changing voltage.
Two.
Say again. I couldn't hear the whole word.
Just said strike two. So the question is, would I go up with strike three?
Yep, I guess you got a good chance, 50-50.
What else Solon wants to venture, I guess, out of C and D? Nobody's speaking up. I'll say let's try D, and let's see if I can get three answers wrong, and we'll see.
Well, no, you got it right. One of the giveaways to me would be that it starts with VAR. So you kind of get an idea that maybe someone, when he decided to name it, something's being variable. So yes, a varactor, V-A-R-A-C-T-O-R, is a semiconductor device that changes its capacitance as you apply a changing voltage. So it's a voltage-controlled variable capacitor called the varactor. Choice C, germanium, is an element. So it's not even really, you could make germanium diodes and germanium semiconductors, but in and of itself, it's basically just an element. So it's not even a device. So the answer for tonight was varactor. Now, if you knew it, then you knew it. But if you didn't know it, then I could understand knowing it. It's not one of those things that can be particularly logicked out, except for the VAR at the beginning of the word.
That makes sense. I knew germanium wasn't the right one, but out of the other three, did not really know that. Is this question something that would possibly be found on the general or the extra exam?
Well, although I do not take these questions from the question pool, I would assume it would be a reasonable one, especially when you get up to both general and extra. They will occasionally show you a diagram, a field effect transistor, and do something relatively simple about it. So, yeah, I would see this probably more likely in an extra than in a general, but yeah.
Got it. Thank you. All right, well, with that, I'm going to bid you adieu and time to retire. Have a good night, 73.
73, Maxim, have a good night, have a good week. We'll talk to you down the line. This is AC2GS with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net, and we're here on the second and fourth Wednesday every month at 9 p.m. We go for as long as we need to go. If anyone has any comments or questions or closing comments before we call it a night, then please feel free to hit that push to talk and say your piece.
Excuse me, comment.
Two questions, kind of. Hopefully they'll be quick ones.
Okay, Bob, you doubled with someone else, the person who wasn't Bob. Could you ID yourself?
ZV, I got a comment.
Okay, if it's just a comment, feel free to comment, William.
I've been doing this thing, trying to stay logged into Echolink, and I keep being kicked off of Echolink because I get a notice that says peer requested disconnect. I'm not sure understanding why that happens. It happened at least four times during the session tonight, and I don't see rhyme or reason why it's doing it. Who would the peer be? Would that be you kicking me off, or would that be somebody else, or I don't know.
Well, I don't know what to tell you, William. I would never kick you off. I logged on myself to maintain this connection because, as I think I mentioned to you earlier, if no one is, I see you're back on it. I didn't do it. Sometimes it has to do with the computer or the application that you're using, the ISP provider. If he drops too many packets, Echolink will terminate the connection. So I've gotten into the habit of the computer that I run the separate Echolink connection. I reboot it because I find that if it's a couple of days old, having not been rebooted, that it will drop the connection also repeatedly. And I certainly don't drop myself either. So I didn't mechanically bump you at all. It's just Echolink doing weird things. Maybe it's your internet provider packet loss and something like that. But I look at me. It's maintained my connection this entire time. This time, but I think last time we talked about this, I had dropped out repeatedly. Similarly, so it was just kind of a funky connection that Echolink made on my computer. It's very sensitive to the peer that you set it for and other things. It's not the most perfect piece of software there is. Another thing that drives me insane is the audio devices shift. So I could get up in the morning and take a look at the window, find that it has reassigned the device, the audio devices, to something completely inappropriate.
I hear that. I don't know. I've been having issues with the Wi-Fi here, but it's been stable on the correct Wi-Fi channel the whole time, and I do a speed test. There's nothing wrong with the Wi-Fi, so it must be packet loss past me. Why it says a peer requested a disconnect rather than, you know, there was too much packet loss and we cut you off, I mean, that's an interesting failure message. Obviously, the messenger launches no matter how the connection is lost, but interesting failure message.
Yeah, I don't know what peer group it's alluding to.
Kicked off. It says peer requested disconnect. And then I'm knocked off. And so I thought that was weird. I was wondering if you get that same error message where peer requested disconnect, you get knocked off too.
I tell you, I don't remember. I just remember that it indicates that the connection was broken, and usually I feverishly re-click on because there's no one else on the Echolink. That means that I'm silented. As it is, unfortunately, I set an automatic timer because the club decided that past 11 o'clock we shouldn't allow people to transmit on Echolink. And so more than once or twice I was on this 11 o'clock and I didn't remember, and the automatic pilot simply disconnected my audio and the ability to transmit through this Echolink. And I've since changed the timeout from 11 o'clock to 11:30. So, you know, it works in mysterious ways.
Thank you for all the clarification of all that. The only other thing that I noticed is that at times the Echolink did cut out, even though I was connected, and then after a while he came back in. You know, it puts a little chevron in front of who's talking. Even it put the chevron up, but no audio came through. It seems like there must be issues within the network, because my connection to wherever core I go to swears it's like super fast, so I have no idea what the rest of the network looks like.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's all kinds of nonsense that goes on. There are people out there who have ISP providers that block ports. This Sunday on my other technical net, a gentleman came on because his ISP provider was blocking the ports that he needed to access IRLP. And he wanted to know what the hell to do about that. I suggested that he consider a virtual private network, because that way you can skirt your ISP provider's port lockdowns. Of course, you have to make sure that the VPN server doesn't lock down those ports as well. So is that it for tonight with you, William? If so, I'll move back to said he had a few questions. I guess he stepped away. Bob, you have a few questions, you said.
Yeah, two. Well, actually, the first one should be real fast. I just can't figure out how to get to the current TechNet puzzle. Maybe you just haven't done this stuff yet because it's early in the year. I tried puzzle.ac2gs.com, and of course, it made it 2022. But on the Kings County Radio Club page, I can't find it. And I went to the Met Archives, and I just can't find it. Maybe there's another. Anyway, back to you on that one, and then I'll ask the other one.
Well, yeah, it's unfortunately, I guess I haven't gotten around yet to redirect the aliases. The alias should work, though, for the front page, so I'll have to check that out. This is the first entry this month, so there's a couple of things needed turning out, so I definitely have to do a redirection.
Okay, fine, no problem. I figured that was it, but also it seemed like Maxim and maybe some other people were on that page, so it's there and they somehow found it. But anyway, yeah, once you do that, you know, then I just what I do. The other one is, it's interesting about this battery and my 7100 with the clock. Try setting it again and seeing if, because it doesn't do what that video you sent me does with his thing was, it just every time you turn it on it goes back to zero, you know, midnight on probably January 1st, whatever year they do. And this one doesn't do that, it just has weird times. So maybe it's just as much of a puzzle to you as it is to me. Back to you.
AC2GS, by the way, the front page link does work, so because I did that recently, so I just have to do the redirect the puzzle.kc2rc.com and puzzles.kc2.com. That's weird. I don't know what to tell you. It's possible that it has that the design in yours has some kind of half-assed capacitor that kind of holds a partial charge, kind of randomizes the CPU setting, but I don't know for sure. It seems to be deeply involved getting that battery in and out from what I saw on that YouTube. So it's not a simple procedure by far.
Copy of that. I watched that YouTube, and there's no way in hell I'm going to try anything like that. And just write it off, just like ignore whatever those numbers are in the upper right-hand corner. I have other clocks. My computer sits right next to my radio, and usually the screen's up, so I look at my computer for what time it is. Just a little funny that I'll glance at, and then for a couple seconds, oh, no, it's not 3:30 or, you know, whatever, it's some irrelevant time. Oh, yeah, that's right. It's a little bit annoying, but... Well, the other thing, what is that front, going back to the puzzle, I just don't remember what the link is that does work. Where do you go for that? I guess maybe I've just never used that method. I don't remember what that is.
Yeah, in the middle of the front page, in kind of orange-colored type, it says, check out our KCRC TechNet puzzle for January 11th and solutions for previous puzzles during 2023. And that link works. Right below it is, check out all of our KCRC TechNet puzzles and their solutions for 2017, 2018, 2019, 2020, 2021, and each separately linked.
Okay, so it's just the home page, and just found out how to get to the home page.
2ZV.
Yes, William?
It's interesting that if I try to say something at the same time you try to say something, it seems like you win, and I can hear you properly over the echo link, although I can't hear if I'm being doubled, on the air. So that I think that's interesting. Can you explain that?
Well, I could certainly explain to you why I win on Echolink, because I'm running the node here. So if it has a direct transmission from me, it's going to favor mine to your radio transmission. It's not going to listen to the radio. It's busy transmitting on the radio, so it has no way to listen to you on the radio. So because mine is the node for Echolink, I win here. Depending upon signal strength and who captures, sometimes you hear two relatively perfect entwined voices. Usually you hear one reasonably well and the others distorted beyond all understanding.
And I also hear both being totally distorted. The thing I hear is that when you're talking, I hear the Morse code signature of the repeater come through in the background when it comes through.
Well, that's because I'm transmitting to the radio, and the way that the controller works is it superimposes that audio onto the transmitted signal. So it's a phenomena of the transmitter.
But it's obvious that just doing a simple audio mix with the Morse code thing and your voice, because it's interesting that you're talking, that goes through. I think when other people are talking, it's an interrupt.
Well, it really shouldn't, because ultimately my connection to the transmitter is the same as yours. I have my FDM-400 to go into my antenna, so sending a signal to our repeater. It's not wired with the repeater. The repeater has no internet access whatsoever. It's all RF-driven.
The Echolink is getting to the repeater through your radio?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm trying to say. The Echolink is all operating at my shack. It's being relayed to the repeater with my radio. So it's all me here. That's what Echolink is. The repeater site itself, you will not see any kind of trace of any Echolink circuits. There's no PC, computers. There's nothing that you would recognize as Echolink. It's all being operated remotely via my shack.
The repeater hears, goes into Echolink, so whatever happens outside happens, and then Echolink people would go out the repeater. Okay, yeah, makes sense, but it only goes out the repeater because you're transmitting, right?
Right. I am the interface. Anything that travels through the Echolink node, either whatever you say on Echolink gets transmitted through my radio. Anything received by my radio gets sent as an audio stream down the Echolink node.
The capability of raising the audio level of the Echolink participants.
Yes, I do, but it's not a varying one. So in, say, yesterday's episode where Berlat was underdriving her microphone, I could raise hers, but when someone else who checked in at a proper level, he would distort. So I kind of have to leave it at a certain point so that people don't overdrive and distort their audio.
I thought at one point the other gentleman that was on Echolink was low, and then slowly during the time he was chatting with you, it went up. So I don't know what was going on, but maybe he got better.
Yeah, I think you're talking about Chuck. Chuck, you know, I think he had his mouth kind of different angles from the microphone. So sometimes he was louder and sometimes he was quieter. But, you know, there's really no sophisticated auto gain function with any of these, and probably would cause more problems than it would solve. So unfortunately, what I do is I aim for no one distorting. You know, if they're good enough to have the proper level, and that's why there's an echo test node for people to kind of check out their setup and make sure that their microphone gain is adequate so they can hear what their own signal is echoed back to them. So for those people, I would hate for them to overdrive Echo Link and to distort, you know, to deal with people who unfortunately are underdriving their microphones for whatever application they're using.
The levels are set pretty good. What's happening is when I'm talking, I get the little red line pretty much towards the end of the thing. And when you're talking, I also get the red line pretty much towards the end of the thing. Seems like almost that maybe I'm too loud.
Well, I don't recall. I don't remember you being particularly too loud. As you said, you know, you're kind of supposed to be kind of close to the, you're not supposed to overdrive, but you're supposed to come relatively close to the maximum amount. You know, you get the best signal-to-noise ratio that way. So it's sort of a shame that people don't avail themselves of the echo test node. It would give them at least more insight into what their audio sounded to others. Again, they would have to be aware of how to adjust the microphone gain for whatever device they're using. If you can't change that, then knowing that it's bad doesn't really help you a great deal.
You go. Thanks a lot for all your comments tonight in the TechNet. I think I have to get along and finish up my supper. So thanks a lot for all your help tonight, Roy.
You're very welcome, William. 73. Enjoy your supper. Be well, and we'll speak again down the line. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If anyone has any closing questions, comments, or what have you, please hit that push-to-talk button. Say your piece.
KD2NVB, I found the page, the puzzle page. Thanks, Roy. And thanks for a great net tonight.
Yeah, you're very welcome, and thank you, Bob, for being my co-host here. If you look, I mentioned it kind of every, the beginning of every TechNet about the orange color type in the middle of the front page. But before I leave tonight, I will fix the redirection so that you'll be able to do the puzzles.kc2rc.com and get there as well.
Hey, thanks, Roy. Yeah. So, I just feel like somebody's like, oh, somebody that just, you know, just goes along. I've heard it. And I'm not listening to every word. Anyway, yeah, that sounds great. Great net, and I guess I'll say 73s too.
Okay, very good. 73 to all. And the next thing you hear will be my little closing spiel. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York, and meet on the first Wednesday of each and every month. Our next meeting will be February 1st, which will be by telecom. We will have an in-person parallel meeting that will be interfaced with our Zoom meeting. We call it a hybrid meeting. Information is on our club's website. Club members will be emailed with details of logging into the meeting. Non-members wishing to join a general meeting can email me with some form of identification for a required link. Unfortunately, we do not accept anonymous requests because you never know what people will do on a Zoom link. Although our meetings informally begin after 7 p.m., our formal regular meeting, general meeting, starts at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 to 10 p.m., depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m., and we also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz for sideband. We offer an audio audio stream of our Kings County Radio Club repeater, C2RC, on the internet, as well as our 10-meter net. Just type into your browser, stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club website. If you would like to contact the host of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website hosting services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based hosting company, 3 Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. Try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. Well, it's time to roll this all up and shut it down, but we'll be back to do this all over again January 25th. You're all welcome to join us. To all the people that participated tonight, especially Bob, KD2NVB, without you guys, I would just be talking to myself. So, this is Roy, AC2GS, going clear, and getting the heck out of here. Stay safe, be well, we'll talk down the line.